This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Today's show is brought to you by FanDuel. Sign up online or in the app for a free 1 week trial. Just $4.99 a month for your all access pass. Playing now on FanDuel is Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Mania. This horror anthology comprises of four distinct segments that feature a raucous combination of satirical humor, horror, gore, and enough surprises to satisfy most horror enthusiasts.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to another FanDuel video podcast. I'm Hooman, and I'm alone. There's no Bryn, and there's no Chris, but that's okay. We're still going to give you another great show. I'm really excited to introduce everyone to our guest today. His name is Obi Bentz, and his film Heavy Petting is now on FanDuel, and we're going to talk about that soon. But Obi, tell us about yourself.
Well, actually, it's a long story. I'm writing a memoir, but that'll be later. It's called The Making of a Fanatic. My problem was that I inherited money when I was 21, and I had a tremendous moral belief in social justice. So I went to San Francisco and started a whole bunch of foundations, which I did for 10 years, and then went on to making films. So I made a film about U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, nominated for an Oscar, and then went to make this film, Heavy Petting, which is also based on, some of your viewers will remember the film Atomic Cafe, which was based on archival footage from the Army about essentially a reenactment of World War III by the War Department during World War II. So we did the same thing with sex education films. We got old films from that had been done for in relation to any film that had been done overtly about sexuality or about, you know, kids growing up, and tried to put it together into a feature.
I want to go back to something you said before we get into Heavy Petting and social justice and films on sexuality. When you were 21 and you inherited that money, did you know that money was coming your way, or was it a big surprise?
No, well, this is such an interesting story. It's a whole different one because there'll be a movie about me at some point. I was a radical in the 60s, and I enjoyed everything from like free love to marijuana. And I was from a middle class family, though. And my grandfather had started a company called Sunbeam Bread, which is that little girl eating a buttered white bread. So he gave me money when I was two. And I sort of knew a little bit about what it was, but I wasn't really sure. And then, boom, when I was 21, I got this trust. And my income was, in inflation corrected, was like almost $400,000 a year. Wow. At 21 years old with nothing to do except my kind of moral commitment to women's rights, fighting racism, low-income people's rights, that kind of thing.
Wow. That's, man, I mean, talk about being born at the right time, at the right place, to the right family. Look at you. All right, well, let's talk about Heavy Petting. I mean, it's now on FanDuel. I'm dying to talk to you about this cast. Sandra Bernhardt, Frances Fisher, David Byrne, Allen Ginsberg. How did you get these people to all say yes? What was it like working with them? I mean, tell us as much or as little as you want here.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, Ginsberg I had met in the 70s. He was essentially the United States' most renowned poet, in addition to being gay. And he was, I just called him up and I said, hey, and he agreed to do it. So then the day before the shoot, he called and said, hey, Bill is in town. Why don't we ask him to come? And I'm like, whoa, Bill, William Burroughs, are you kidding me? So we arranged him in a two shot. It's the only two shot they've ever been in together. And the interplay with them is fascinating. We couldn't get into the gay themes. I mean, it was tough because none of the films that we acquired from the 40s, 50s, 60s, any of them had, there was the tiniest reference to maybe one girl who had too much affection for a girlfriend of hers. That was That was it. So we really couldn't get into gay themes particularly well. Anyway, they were terrific. Frances Fisher, I just knew as a friend. You know, she is, famously Kate Winslet's mother from Titanic. You know, she was just a very charming, you know, energetic New Yorkie type. Well, she's British, actually, but New Yorkie type actress. Sandra Bernhardt came through a casting director. It was also, you know, so I had met her for the first time. By the way, that was interesting with her because there were three gay people I interviewed, of which she was one, and none of them would admit on camera in the late 80s that they were gay. Hmm. You know, I sort of worked around with her and I have to obviously respect their professional decisions about whether or not to reveal that, because at that point it actually was tough on some of their careers. In the same way that John Leguizamo just said that he wouldn't, you know, the actor who's been in a bunch of action films, he would not go out into the sun because he didn't want to darken his skin.
Wow. You know, I've interviewed John Leguizamo two or three times. I can't even believe he admitted to that. That's
Well, now at this point. I worked with him once, too. Also, we did a benefit for Norman Lear's group, People for the American Way. He's a terrific guy.
Man, I couldn't agree more. He is the most warm, welcoming person.
Yeah, terrific. And for him, and he's so short, too, for him to do all these action films.
I know. Yeah. It is pretty funny. Well, tell me about the film festival circuit in the late 80s. Where did you take Heavy Petting? Where did you guys go with it?
Well, we first went to Sundance, of course, and that's where I was the same year as Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Steven Soderbergh's first film. And we were the balance of fiction, nonfiction, sexuality. And we sold there for $500,000, which for a documentary, even corrected for inflation, is probably more than $1 million. It's never happens, you know. Wow. So anyway, and then we had a full distribution of theaters in the United States. I went to the Tokyo Film Festival, all over Europe, Venice, Cannes, Ghent, all these things.
You were able to take this one film to the most premier film festivals?
As a documentary, which is like incredible, because it's a comedy and it plays, but also I think it has a strong element of Americana in it. You know, I mean, nobody else made these kind of films, which are supposed to be sensitive to kids, but also we had that wacky documentary footage, like the father having the 5-year-old boy in boxing clubs get beaten up by some other kid because he thought that it was kind of a macho thing for children to do.
Tell us what happened at the Moscow Film Festival.
Oh yeah, Moscow. You see, Moscow was they had a sidebar called Sex in American Cinema, and it had Blue Velvet, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Working Girls, which is that film. It's not Working Girl, it's Working Girls was a film about a whorehouse run by women. And so we opened that. And the strange thing about film festivals in Moscow at that point is that they just, as a filmmaker, they turned the volume down on your soundtrack, which were full of these, 60s, 50s, 60s, terrific rock and roll songs. And then one guy read the entire transcript while the film was going on. Anyway, a woman came up to me, and there's lots of laughter, and then I talked afterwards to a translator. A woman came up to me afterwards and said, "Thank you so much for this film. You know, I wish my son could have seen this, because one time when he was young, he called me and said, 'I have to go to the hospital. You have to call an ambulance immediately.' And he wouldn't tell me what was wrong. And when he got in the ambulance and he went off, and then when we were at the hospital, the ambulance driver pulled me aside and said, 'You know what it was? He had masturbated and ejaculated, and he thought that his body was coming apart because he had no sex education.'"
Wow. Hilarious. So you made this film in the 80s. Are you still surprised that the film has an impact on people today?
Yeah, totally, because it's... Well, I mean, sexuality, of course, teenage sexuality is awkward everywhere in the world, I think. I mean, even in Bali, so you have to kind of go through these things where you're learning yourself what's going on. And the funny thing about these worthy films, really, where they were made by McGraw-Hill, which was an encyclopedia book company, the idea was in the 50s, there were progressive liberal type people that thought that you should be able to talk openly about these issues. And they did. So we felt at that point that we could put it together. But even now, there's this controversy about sex education in schools, and You know, obviously I'm on the side that thinks the more you talk about these things, the better. Whereas the right wing thinks it's like training for sexuality or something like that. You know, and of course the film goes through the whole problem with VD, getting pregnant. And naturally no teenager wants to get pregnant. You know, so I mean, all of these issues are addressed one way or another. You know, as well as just the pure, you know, male-female balance of it. I mean, there's a story in the film where one girl says that she was just dry humping with her boyfriend and she had an orgasm. And she said, oh, I didn't like it. And I got rid of told him he had to leave. He didn't understand. And I went in and talked to my sister and told her the story. And the sister tells my friend, oh, you must be mistaken. Girls cannot have orgasms.
Wow. Crazy.
Let's talk about films that had a huge impact on you as you were growing up. Is there three or four movies that, I don't know, you go back to time and time again, or movies you think about a lot that maybe you could share with us that kind of impacted the trajectory of your life, or just films you really loved?
Yeah, well, it's tough because, I mean, few of them were documentaries as I was really growing up, because at that point it was very hard to see documentaries. You couldn't stream all this stuff. You had to actually go to a theater. I mean, so I loved Nanook of the North in terms of documentaries, and which were really incredible. But it was pretty routine, frankly. I mean, I loved Apocalypse Now and Godfather, all that sort of thing, Chinatown. You know, the sort of mainstream, you know, smart, dynamic films. I mean, there were also films, more independent films, like My Dinner with Andre, which was just two people talking at a table more or less for the entire time as I began working in film. You know, I mean, in the early stages, I was very much into these documentaries about social issue politics. But in terms of entertainment film, for your audience and now for really pretty much anybody who wants to enjoy things, I think it was really kind of conventional. I mean, I deeply admired. And of course, I was in San Francisco in the time. Oh, there's a funny story about, you remember Obi-Wan Kenobi, right?
Of course, yeah. You know?
Well, okay. Do you remember his nickname is Ben, right?
Yeah.
So Obi-Wan, Ben. Okay. I had been, during this social justice period in San Francisco, there was articles about me in the newspaper. And I always wondered whether I was a good guy, or there were good guy articles doing this good thing. Whether it would look as subliminally had gotten in his mind that Obi-Wan, how does Obi-Wan Kenobi get to Ben? You know, so yes. Anyway, so I actually had an opportunity. I went to a screening, a private screening of Apocalypse Now before it was finished, when it actually had the other ending. Yeah. And Lucas and all these other people were there. So I had the chance to go up to him and say, my name's Obi-Ben, you know, how did you get them? You know, and then he just kind of said, oh, I like to make characters, and kind of scurried away. I mean, I think I didn't know if he saw a lawsuit in the coming in the back.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, because I, you know, I didn't want to be too cliche with my questions and say, how many people mix you up with the guy from Star Wars? How did you end up with the name Obi? But yeah. I do know George Lucas. I've met him several times over several occasions, and he is a little awkward. He does scurry away exactly the way you described. So since you brought it up, how did you end up with this name, Obi?
Oh, well, my real name's Alan. My middle name is Oberly. I was from a Swiss family, going back to my great-great-grandmother or something like that, and they always called me Obi. And look, I love it. I mean, I have a friend, an artist, a terrific artist friend. His name is Robert Reynolds. He's impossible to Google, right? But I think I'm the only Obi Benz in the world, right? There's like Obi Trice and a few other people, but you know, so I'm very Googleable. Also, it's short.
And I'm dying to know, do you like the Star Wars universe?
Oh, totally, man, totally.
Okay,
I mean, it's brilliant, brilliant.
If you were to say, I absolutely hate it, I can't believe they used my name, that would be another thing.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I love good conventional films. I mean, you know, independent films are wonderful. I mean, love all these Chinese these fabulous, all the Kurosawa films.
It's interesting because, you know, Alex Guinness, towards the end of his life, just hated doing interviews about Star Wars. Are you familiar with that? The
guy right, I'm sure of that.
All right. So what's next for you, Obi? How can we keep in touch with you and see what you're up to? Like, what are you working on next?
Well, like I said earlier, I've written two books that are memoirs. One's called The Making of a Fanatic. The second one is called which is just Up Until I Inherit the Money. Then the second one is The Adventures of a Fanatic, which is that whole decade in San Francisco and all that was going on. Are you in San Francisco? Where are you based?
I'm right outside, near Stanford University.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I started a foundation in San Francisco to give away money to social justice projects. And we did amazing stuff. And we funded Margaret St. James, who was a former prostitute, organization called Coyote, Call Off Your Old Tired Ethics, which was supportive of sex workers. This is in the 70s. And we funded it with tax-exempt money. You know, I promoted all these No Nukes benefits with Jackson Brown and Bonnie Raitt, Graham Nash and all of these people for years, which led to a huge Madison Square Garden show. But I, you know, worked in a really interesting field with Peter Coyote, for instance, who was an actor as well, who at that point was Governor Jerry Brown had appointed to be the arts director of the state of California. And at that point, Jerry Brown was refusing to live in the governor's mansion. He lived in an apartment in Sacramento. He ran the seventh largest government budget in the world. You know, it was an amazing time in San Francisco and in California. We had to deal. I organized conferences for people with inherited money to talk about how to most effectively give it away. It was really a crazy scene.
You definitely lived like five lifetimes in one lifetime. Are you as busy today as you were back then?
Well, writing the book, yes. I mean, also not only that, I've been married four times.
Holy cow!
Divorced three.
How many kids you got?
Three kids. No, three? I mean, I decided at the end of my, you know, when I was 30 and started filmmaking, I decided to cool out that whole social justice thing. I felt I had done my time and tried to be a good, you know, better sort of person rather than a fanatical person. So, I mean, now, you know, I devoted more time to my kids and I've enjoyed it.
So can I explore the whole four times marriage with you, or should we leave that alone?
I'm up to anything.
So are all three of the kids from like three of the different women?
That's a good one. No, my first marriage was for a Brazilian girlfriend that I was totally in love with, that she went back to Brazil. Second one was a terrible mistake where I married someone from Texas, I can't even imagine why it happened. But
how long did the second one last?
That was 1 year. Thank God. Let me tell you, 1 year. That was long enough. Okay. From Texas. Don't ever do that unless they're from Austin. Okay. Okay. Then the third one I actually was really totally in love with. It was fabulous. Who worked with Coppola too, by the way, in production design. And had two kids with her. That lasted until they were 4 and 8, when she said she wasn't in love with me anymore. And I'm the most lovable guy. Come on. But anyway, all I had to do after a year of couples counseling was say yes. And then finally I landed now. So I had two kids with that, with a wonderful artist from Taiwan. And we have a 13-year-old, you know. Wow. So I feel very fortunate.
So how long have you been married to the fourth one? How many years?
Let me think. 12.
Oh, okay. So this one sounds like a keeper.
A keeper, exactly. Well, I think the problem is more enduring me. You know, I mean, I've always thought that I was just this, you know, terrific guy who everyone would always love and I'd always do the right thing. But that isn't what my companions feel. I think that it's like they feel like I'm sort of a pushy, know-it-all type of guy that, you know, wants to do things his way. You know, so funny. And anyway, this one, I believe, will be able to endure me.
Wow. Oh, but you know what the greatest thing about you is? Obviously, I interview a ton of people. You are an open book. You don't have any secrets.
No, thank God.
You're willing to share it all.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. Well, do you ever make it out to the Bay Area anymore?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, pre-COVID, obviously. But yeah. Absolutely. And in fact, I can't wait for this COVID to be over. Really.
I know. Come on. We're all hoping and praying.
I really think that it's going to become endemic. And that, and things will lighten up in the spring, and then we'll unfortunately have to mask for a while, you know, and then you will be getting shots. I mean, that's what I hope, you know, that's my view. But anyway, yes, of course, I'll be out there.
His name is Obi Benz. His film is Heavy Petting. It's now on Fandor. I mean, listen, what a great interview this guy has been. Just support the film because he's such a good guy. Thank you so much for your time, Obi.
Actually, who, man? Thanks, buddy. See you.
All right, brother.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in. Today's show is brought to you by Fandor. Sign up online or in the app for a free 1-week trial. Playing now on Fandor is Herschel Gordon Lewis's Blood Mania. This horror anthology comprises of 4 distinct segments that feature a raucous combination of satirical humor, horror, gore, and enough surprises to satisfy most horror enthusiasts. That's FANDOR, the home for cinephiles.